Welcome to Circular Firing Squad. I'm Marty Gentius, counseling faculty at Kent State University and host for Circular Firing Squad. We've got the whole band back together again. Wow, this is like a reunion tour. Six members, six questions, and six answers for each question. Questions are generated by each squad member and run from the practical to the punny. Is punny a word? Okay, I'll go with it. Let's see who's with us on this episode.
Hi, everybody. Elliot Ingersoll here.
Hey, everyone. Jen Cook.
Steph Martyr.
Gina Martin.
And Eric Perry.
All right. Everybody's happy to be back together tonight. Our first question goes to Elliot.
Okay, here we go. What is the most accurate source for labor statistics for counselors?
I'm going to be honest, I have absolutely no idea. I use ONET, probably like everyone else that uses the department, the U.S. Department labor statistics. I can't even get out the name of it. I have found that I don't think it's very accurate, though, because it seems vastly under the number of counselors that I actually think that are probably out there. The projections always seem accurate of like, we're projecting we need 50,000 counselors a year over the next 10 years or whatever it is. But that's the only place that I really know to go other than to my friend google.com to tell me things. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, Jen, I'm happy to hear that because I also have absolutely no idea whatsoever. For the most part, I just look around to the people that are in the cohort ahead of me and behind me by a couple years. That's as close as I get to looking up labor statistics on who's doing what at the moment. But I'm interested to hear other people's answers so I can learn something.
This question kind of threw me for a bit because it seemed to be just one answer over and over again in terms of, well, you go to the market statistics. But I thought if I want to know what's going on in the hiring field, talk to practicing counselors. I mean, go to different agencies or talk to ones that are working in agencies and say, what's the market like in your agency? And then if you can, talk to clients and ask them, what's your experience like with a counselor? Do you think more people should do it? You know, what are you going to recommend if you talk to people about it? But just to get a sense of if more are needed and, you know, if the market sees like it needs more too. Or it's available.
So glad that no one knows. We are such an analytical bunch here. I also have no idea. And the first thing that came to mind for me was just talking to other counselors. That's like having a cup of coffee or something like that and sitting down and having the, you know, heart to heart of what's really going on in your job and whatever, all that stuff. So I think just having those honest conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I'll get on board with that. I think ONET is my first resource for kind of the national statistics and taking a look at things. I definitely noticed that the job openings popping up. I still have a lot of contacts in the area and then a few friends that I meet up with every now and then who are supervisors at local agencies that, you know, pretty desperate for work, for help every time I talk to them. Which seems a little crazy to me sometimes just because it feels like there's a lot of counselor ed programs. We're really putting out graduates and we still don't seem to be meeting the need that's out there. So even ONET and you know, the projections that I see, I feel like are sometimes really shooting under the mark with the level of desperation that I hear, at least in my immediate community and the people that I know.
Well, thank you. These are great answers because this came up with a colleague of mine. We were talking, Stephanie Durkar and I were looking, we're doing a study on counselors' relationships to money and everything. And this came up and we were both, yeah, labor statistics. And we know the Northeast Ohio, but then we were like, I don't know, where do you go? And it was like, then I started to get irritated. We're in an information age. We're in an internet age. How much money does American Counseling Association how many checks of ours do they cash? Boy, does that date me. But I mean, they take the money. Shouldn't they be keeping up on some of this stuff? It's kind of like KCRIP. They just put out standards, but they never research them. That starts to bug me. And now I'm heading into counseling QAnon theories, so I'll stop there. But I didn't know either. So thanks, everybody. I'm right there with you. But kind of check out locally, talk to folks locally. But then there seems like we could be doing more. But I'm not quite sure where we should start with that.
I mean, I just want to add in like one other piece is that, you know, with counselor ed jobs, I've been keeping an eye on higher ed jobs for several years, mainly because I'm nosy. And it's been pretty interesting to see the increase and see the changes in the types of jobs that are posted. And so, you know, that's not counseling, it's counselor education. But I mean, over the course of this past year, I would say there's been over 600 or 700 jobs posted for counselor education over, you know, all different types from adjunct to, you know, full-time tenure track assistant, you know, so on and so forth. But it's pretty remarkable. There's definitely an increased need in counselor education, which would probably call to question, well, do we have an increase then in need for counselors as well?
Well, just to echo Eric and Marty, it just seems like, yeah, well, there's a lot of us training people and we're still not filling the need. There's still these huge gaping holes in so many areas. So,
well, I'll add this one last comment that, you know, counselors are traditionally pretty underpaid. And when we look at, especially our new graduates who are, you know, under the auspices of student loan payments starting 6 months after they're done and low wages and needing to fulfill their lives, I think a lot of them are not taking full-time counseling jobs and they're doing part-time counseling to get their hours toward their license. Then they're doing full-time somewhere else to get benefits and a living wage, which means that the needs are not getting fulfilled in the community. So those out there who are listeners who run agencies and places in which they employ counselors, I think you need to think seriously about what your wages are and whether or not you're offering benefits and the rise in contract employment. I'm sorry, no, not for new graduates especially. And I'm done. I'll get off my soapbox and ask my question because I'm next. But I feel pretty passionate around that topic. All right, now it's my question and I'll shut the hell up here. What foods do you eat when traveling that you're unlikely to eat at any other time?
Fast food. When we go on long road trips, that's when I'm like, I'm getting my crispy chicken sandwich from wherever and I'm going to enjoy it. And I also get very disappointed when it's messed up for whatever reason. And we're in the car, you know, obviously it's like not a big deal, but it's like, I was looking forward to that. I get it like three times a year. I want it, but fast food.
This question for me made me think of basically when I travel to conferences. And when you travel to conferences, you're locked into a hotel with hotel food and surrounding restaurants. And you can't just pop down to the kitchen and get something to snack on. I try to leave enough space in my suitcase for, I don't know, I'm not even sure what you call them, but you'll know what I'm talking about. Those boxes that have eight sleeves of little crackers in them, they're Lance's or Captain's wafers or something like that. And I'll bring a box of those along. I think of things that are light, so dry roasted salted peanuts. And then also you can get those little drink powder things that you can mix in a bottle of water. And that might be what I snack on in my room in between meetings or late at night, or if I get up even early in the morning, have something to munch on before breakfast. But that typically I don't eat that stuff outside of traveling, but that is a, when I read the question, that's the travel thing that I take with me.
So interesting. When I travel, and I was just thinking about this today, actually, because I had to do a big round trip, driving trip to Illinois. And I find that I just get really hungry when I travel. And so I eat normally in a normal day. I don't eat like bars, like, you know what I'm talking about, like the granola bars or like a protein bar or whatever. But when I travel, I find that I just eat them nonstop. Like it's a problem. I just like open one, eat a few bites, put it down, eat the rest, put it down, open another, start another, you know, and just keep eating on my entire travel journey. And I don't know why that is. And I really don't eat bars any other time in my life. just when I'm traveling. So that would be mine.
So one of the things I love about traveling is we don't, in my immediate area, we don't have a lot of different options, right? We've had the same restaurants here, I feel like, for the last 20 years. So it's literally anything I can find that isn't what we have here. And I make it a mission to find those things. I love Thai food. So that's one thing I really enjoy. And we don't have a good Thai place really close. So it's something I always look for. But really, it's just any kind of food that I can get my hands on that I can try that I haven't tried before that we don't have here. So get really excited about that and that part of travel.
Well, for me, this was kind of two phases. Before we got legal cannabis in Ohio, if I was traveling in a state that had it, it would be cannabis infused cookies, things like that, that I couldn't normally get. And then going back to Steph's point, fast food, those two kind of go together. And I was always happy as a clam with it. But again, and to tag on Marty, now at this point in my life, it's hotel food. But that's such a little luxury. I just do love it because I cook a lot and I've got finicky eater kids and I'm cooking all these different things. And so when someone brings me a plate of warm food to my room, I'm just like, this is nice. And I pay for it. They don't reimburse for that. You know, you only have a per diem, but I'm like, this is worth it. I just got a warm chicken quesadilla brought to my room and I can watch Star Trek while I eat it. So those are my kind of two phases of travel food.
So I used to have to drive a lot when I was living in Virginia in my doctoral program. I taught in Northern Virginia. I taught down in Southern Virginia. I taught in another school that was about 40 miles away. Like, I was just in the car constantly, and I was in between campuses for Virginia Tech. And so when I would go on these longer car rides, I would find myself at the truck stop getting the chocolate covered bugles. Do y'all know what these are? Like, oh my God, like this is something that I should never purchase. Now, since that time, I don't eat sugar anymore. I think I've said that on the show before, like I don't eat refined sugars. So, you know, that's off the table. So like going up and down the truck stop aisles is not as tempting as it was to me in the past. But I do like to find like those pretzel nuggets that are hot buffalo wing pretzel nuggets, which I don't typically keep those in the house. But if I'm driving in the car, I'm usually picking those up. But when you mentioned, I wasn't thinking about room service, but I love room service and it just feels so decadent. And you get the little salt and pepper shakers and the little bottle of mayonnaise and the little bottle of ketchup. I don't know. It kind of makes me feel like a giant, you know, why not, you know, to be, you know, digging into, you know, you can't even get in those little jars, but they're so damn cute. I don't know why I like them, but yeah, I love it when that tray arrives after I have all the anxiety of, can I take a shower before they come? Can I run down and get a Coke out of the machine before they come? You know, all those kinds of things. But once it finally gets there, that's a really exciting thing. But I will say, like, when I travel by plane, especially on longer flights, and I know that I'm going to need snacks, I buy a lot of dried fruit and sometimes beef jerky. And those are things that I never keep in the house because suddenly being at 35,000 feet makes me want to eat constantly. I have no idea why.
Here's my question. What's your take on Microsoft Outlook?
I hate it. I have to say I hate it, but I keep coming back to it like a obsessed, torturous high school girlfriend. There's nothing that it crosses my mind every once in a while and bothers me, but I have to go back and reimagine the positive ways that I could be using it. Occasionally I catch other people using it and I'm like, wow, they seem to make it work. I only go back to it when, for whatever reason, my mail system, I use Mail app on the Mac, either does a miscount or something like that. I wind up going back to Outlook, but I hate it. I really hate it. Did I make it clear I hate it?
I'm picking up a wee bit of hostility there, Marty, if you'd like to elaborate. We're counselors. I mean,
I hear it loud and clear, Marty, that you really hate Outlook. I don't know if I'm really at that level of hatred with Outlook yet. But for me, the part of Outlook that I absolutely despise and cannot get behind, no matter how hard I try, is the calendar feature. And I know that's like a controversial topic, but the people, and I'm sorry if any of you are this person, but the people that are like, oh, I'm just going to go throw something on your Outlook calendar.
Excuse I hate me. Them. I hate I, them.
I dislike those people greatly. I'm like, I don't have time to sit here and enter in every freaking meeting and every class and every drive time and every phone call and every, I don't have time for that. So if they're going to just slap something on my calendar looks wide open. Like I don't do a damn thing. And that certainly isn't the case. So I really dislike that feature of Outlook and the expectation that I keep it up to date because let's be real. I don't have time to do that.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a strong disdain for it. I think about it more as intrusive in-laws, I think is the analogy I would use. It knows too much of my business. It tries to remind me of things I don't want to hear about. And they've actually added additional features recently that'll give you suggestions. Do you want to send this during your normal workday? Do you want to add this as a task? Stop asking me questions. You know, I don't need this as a part of my life. I feel enough anxiety about what's in there already. I really don't need any more from whatever Microsoft has decided might be helpful for me. I've tried alternatives. I like the simpler alternatives, but sometimes the security features aren't what I need them to be, and I have a hard time getting them to sync up. You know, and the only thing I do like about Outlook is it seems to be the one thing that I can get my accounts and calendars to sync up properly. I do like the calendar feature. It helps me organize my time. But anyone who tries to throw anything at me or my calendar, truly upsets me on a deep emotional level. Don't throw something on my calendar. Just ask and we'll be good.
This was a great question because frankly, I had given it no more thought than garage doors. I was like, yeah, I got to have a garage door, especially with all the bike thefts now, you know. And when you all started talking, I'm like, well, what are the alternatives? I have a Gmail account that gets about 80 spams a day to 5 legitimate messages. So I forward the messages to my Outlook and I delete everything else. I'm thinking just jump into the Gmail. But when someone said that the calendar, putting things on your calendar, that the first time that happened to me, and you know, I'm an analog man. Okay. Let's just be with, I'm going to be what I am. I'm a magnetic tape kind of guy. Okay. And this person had emailed me, a vice president of some goddamn thing. I don't even remember, but you know, they're all interchangeable. But they were like, would you be available for a meeting Monday and blah, blah, blah. And I said, let me check, you know, my calendar. And then I go to the calendar and all of a sudden that meeting pops up. And I was like, whoa, 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 what's going on there? And they had like put it in somehow. And I was like, I didn't even know you could do that. But that did annoy me quite a bit. But I just didn't think there were alternatives. And I never gave it much thought. But this has given me food for thought. Thank you.
Well, there's so many issues. I mean, the integration with Mac is super poor. Let's be honest. Like some features work. Sometimes they work sporadically. They went, you know, when they changed it to where you could have like stacked conversations or split I don't even know the right words, but when they started stacking emails together without my permission in Outlook, I didn't know where these other emails were. Like they were in a thread as opposed to like just being one by one, reading emails, you know, like I can read the trail there right down below. Why do I need you to, you know, I don't need it to be fooled with. But I'm going to tell you what, those little suggestions that you mentioned, Eric, they make me crazy. Until one day, I was about to send an email to a colleague that I'm not a huge fan of because I think that they're lazy. And it says, this is probably like, let's say it was noon. And it said, would you like to send this tomorrow during their regular business hours, which are between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m.? And I was like, you just confirmed their lazy ass to me, didn't you? Oh, they're only on email between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m., huh? And I was like, that's some big brother going on. Like, I mean, that was like heavy big brother. I'm like, what's it saying when people are trying to send me an email? Or I don't know. Like, it was just a little bit wild. That gotcha kind of made me laugh. But you know, what's funny is it's missing things that Gmail does. So if I'm typing an email in Gmail and I mention something about an attachment, maybe I just said, oh, I sent the attachment in my last email. It'll say, do you have an attachment? When you go to hit send, it'll say, is there an attachment you want to put onto this email? Isn't that delightful? Because how many times do you send an email and be like, I meant to put that file on there and you didn't do it. Now Outlook thinks it's so damn smart, but it doesn't do that. And that's what I would like it to do. And I'm going to tell you what, like, do not drop things on my calendar. It is not that hard to send me an email or send me a text and say, hey, are you available tomorrow between 1 and 4 at some point for a meeting with so-and-so and so-and-so? That's not that hard. And it's disrespectful because not all of us are on the 9 to 5. And especially as faculty, we've lost a lot of things in terms of our freedoms and benefits. But being able to schedule my time, I'll be keeping that.
That was cathartic. Listening, I was expecting most people to like, huh? And I really appreciate the passion that some of you had for your distaste, dislike, and yes, even hatred of Outlook. I didn't like it 20 years ago when I was working. I was really happy I got into Gmail, and where really recently had to switch from Gmail to Outlook. And it's just been, I try to ignore Outlook. I try to ignore that it exists. I just forward everything. I just get all my notices through my Gmail because I can't even stand to look at it. It just irritates me. And I don't know why. I don't know why, but I can't stand it. And I miss my Gmail account. I wish we could have it back because it was just simpler. Everything went together. I could get everything. It was easy. I knew where everything was. I didn't have to log in another time. I was just mad about the whole thing.
I miss Clippy. You know, when you don't have a lot of friends, it's nice to have a little animated paperclip that comes up on your screen and talks to you. I guess on the Mac side, and I've switched from over the years from PC to Mac. And I switched after they had the moose. Mac had a little talking moose that would pop up periodically and say things. I probably can search for the software. Someone's probably done it again. And you can have a little talking moose. But yeah, Outlook is not my friend. With people looking for positions coming up, this is the time of year, or people securing positions, we've got a search going on at our university. And I guess my question for the group is, what would be your advice for first-time academics?
Well, I was kind of dreading going first for this one because I am a new academic. I mean, textbook-wise, I am a new academic. I've been teaching for a while, but being in this new faculty role for the past now 2 years has been an interesting transition. And I think my biggest piece of advice coming fresh out of this would be to just look at all components of the job, not just the job itself, but look at the area that you would be living in, look at your commute, look at what the time schedule would be like, look at how the culture is of the department that you're going to be within, look at the culture of the geographic area that you're going to be living in. Just don't look, you know, drive to the grocery store that you're going to be going to and take a walk around, because I think that it can't be said enough or researched enough what your life is going to look like when you make a huge transition like that. And for me, it's, you know, not just me. I'm looking at everyone in my family, moving everyone for the sake of my job. So I think that would be the most important piece of advice that I would give.
Yeah, I thought about this one for a while because it's really hard to say like that one kind of quintessential piece of advice. For me, I think, though, the people are everything. Who you're going to work with is everything. And that's leadership. That's your department. That's the supports that your students are going to have, that you're going to have. One of the things that I noticed first about where I am now is that my first call to IT, they were happy to hear from me. Right. And I know that sounds weird, but I've been at other institutions that they're so overworked and stressed. They answer the phone and they're like, hello, are you sure there's a problem? Are you sure you're not just OK? You know, I mean, they're sweating on the other end of the line. There's people waiting. You know, there's ways to tell whether or not that's a positive culture. If the support staff is treated well, your administrative staff is treated well, if they're happy, if they're content, if they enjoy coming to work and dealing with the faculty, you might too. I really feel like that the institution and the culture that you find there, the people that you work with and you interact with, make all the difference and really, really shape that environment for your work. You teach alone, but there's so much collaboration in this work that's required to be successful in terms of accreditation, projects, research, all the things that you might want to do as an academician. Really, you need that to be successful in that. And I really feel like that's the one thing I needed to find first.
Yeah, I've got a, well, the worst advice is advice, right? But I got a couple of thoughts, and starting with Eric, you know, it's like, and Gina, the people, make sure you fit. But before you know if you fit, find out who you are and be that. Do not go in with a phony persona. Be who you are. And then if you fit with the people, that is, I think that is the most important thing. Once you're in there, though, then, you know, it depends on your temperament. Some people, they're really driven for leadership. So, you know, some people have an animal sense of smelling where the power is. Find out where the power is. That's perfectly fine. And then find out what work is not being done that needs done and make yourself valuable. And then, you know, if you want to move up the ranks or maybe you want to do administration, that's a good way to do that. But you also, sometimes it's just nice to work with a group that really respects scholarship and teaching, and that's your primary focus. I always felt as a department chair, my goal was always to keep non-essential work away from the faculty so they could do what they do best. But then I know there's a lot of chairs who want to dump all of the very difficult tasks like K-CREP stuff onto the newer hires, and that's just not fair.
I love everything that I'm hearing, and I'm over here nodding the entire time everyone's speaking. I would say the first thing that I recommend to people that I mentor is to pay attention to what you want and write it down, and not just about the job. You know, there are the components about the job of like, do you want more research intensive? Do you want more teaching intensive? Do you not want to do any research at all? Do you want heavy service? You know, all of those things, write them down. They're important. But then you got to start thinking about like, well, what's my lifestyle? Do I want to be rural? Do I want to be urban? Do I want to be in a suburban environment? Do I have children to figure into that mix, or a partner? Are you single and hoping to mingle? You got to figure that into the mix. Probably going out to the middle of nowhere is not going to be working for the single and mingling crowd. So thinking about that situation, going to a rural institution of 2,000 people is probably not going to be the match. And it's not selfish to think about the whole spectrum of your life when thinking about where you're applying and where you might go. And it's okay to say no to jobs that aren't a fit. For brand newbies, I would say avoid any job that says assistant/program director, assistant professor/practicum and internship coordinator, assistant/guru to everyone in the program. Like, that's a red flag, y'all. If you are a brand new assistant, you need time to get your feet under you before you start taking on program leadership. Not because you can't do it, but because it's challenging to take on that role for the first time. Even if you've been, you know, well-trained, well-groomed, well-developed, all of those kinds of things, give yourself time to learn and grow into those roles. Give yourself a shot to be an academic who's being mentored, as opposed to walking in the door and expecting to be the know-it-all for the program, because it's a recipe for disaster. And I've seen it over and over and over again with new faculty where they get into those situations. If you don't have somebody who's mentoring you through this process, somebody to help you like go through the pros and cons and to figure out how to do this, find somebody. Find somebody you think is cool. You know, one of us sounds neat to you, send us an email and be like, hey, can I just get a half hour of your time? Because we have all been there and been through this. And it's better to reach out to a stranger who's not involved, and it doesn't matter to them how close you are to your mama's house or how the school district's going to be able to give you that feedback, than to not have it at all and only be guided by the people who are pulling on you in your life. So get that help. Don't sit in isolation, because a lot of times people don't feel comfortable talking to their cohort members or even the faculty where they're doing their doctoral programs about this. And that's okay. But get other help. Please get other help and don't go it alone, because it's a very challenging decision to make. And you want to try to make a decision that's going to be sustainable for some period of time. And it's okay if it ends up to be a mistake. You can change your mind. You will get hired again. Don't worry. But get the help that you need. Don't do it alone. Sorry, I have a lot to say about that topic.
I was pretty appreciative of it, not only for the words of wisdom from all of you, but also because I really am not in a position to offer any advice for first time academics, since that hasn't been something I've experienced yet. So I'm just taking in what everyone's saying. And I was trying to think of how to approach this question in a way that I could kind of tweak it. But at the same time, just listening to the things that you had to say, I feel like was good, and just giving that time.
There's a small little restaurant, takeout food, but they have chairs in it across the street from Whitehall. And it's changed owners, changed menus over the years. But it was a place that, probably more so when I was younger, I would walk across the street and get something from there. And every time I went there, people were happy. They were happy to see whoever came in the door. They were kind. They looked happy in their jobs. And from that, I thought that if ever this academic thing didn't work out, I'd walk across the street and ask them if they've got a job. So the first realization I came to was that you can be happy in other jobs. Now, I don't want to turn the light off on new academics, but if you take your work too seriously, it's going to consume you. I mean, it will eat you up. So always keep the idea in your head that there is a small little restaurant across the street that you can be just as happy working in than in an academic field. And some of you who listen, some of you on this group might have switched careers, and or careers have been switched on you. And because of that, you kind of realize that there's always something else that you could be doing that will be just as fulfilling. But when you get to that point of change, you're really scared that it's not going to be as good as what I had. It is. Just don't take your job too seriously.
Yeah, I appreciate everyone's answers on that, too. I think that there's so much that goes into this job, because it's more than just a job. It is a lifestyle. And if you depend too heavily on that, it can consume you. So yeah, very appreciative of everyone's answers. To switch gears completely, we are finally, this is my second Wisconsin winter now, and we're finally starting to see some of the first signs of spring. And so I want to know, in different parts of the country, what are some of the first signs of spring where you live?
So I'm in northwestern Pennsylvania. For us, it snows less than once a week, I think, is what we get to in the spring. That's what we're looking for. So just to give some context, it was about 82 degrees here today, and it's going to snow by Tuesday, so 2 days from now. It's really confusing to determine when spring begins in this particular area. But, you know, the snowfall is a thing, right? The above freezing temperatures. I would say shorts become a thing, but when you live in the north, you see them in the winter too. So that's not really a good barometer for that.
Well, I love this question because a couple weeks ago, I went out. I have a herb garden outside, and then I raise herbs inside all through the colder weather. And I went outside and my chives coming back up. And those chives were given to my partner by a coworker in, I'm going to say 1997. And nature, holy socks. You know, they come back every year and they provide all sorts of fuel for recipes that I work in. So the herb garden coming back, that's my thing. But yeah, like Eric says, it's like, I don't know. Today, you know, yesterday was like 85, and I'm like, I don't buy it. And you know, I don't look at the weather ahead too much but then my kid is like, oh yeah, it's going to be 49 tomorrow. I was like, ah, there you go. It comes and goes. But yeah, the chives would be my thing.
I was so laughing when you're asking this question, Gina, and you mentioned Wisconsin, because you all know I spent 7 years in Wisconsin and it's going to snow there tomorrow. What was it on Saturday? It was like 85 and it's going to snow tomorrow. And so, Eric, when you were like, it snows once a week as opposed to every other day, like I've lived that here in southern New Hampshire. We haven't gotten that much snow this year. I mean, we got killed a couple of times, but like the amount of snow, it's just not been like it was. And this is only my second spring here, but I feel like there is more spring here compared to when I was in Milwaukee, where, I mean, spring is a horrible season in Milwaukee because you are just dying for it to get warm, and it's rainy, it's windy, it's cold, it's snowy. I mean, it's terrible. And you have 175 degree day thrown in for fun, you know, here and there too. And when I lived in Colorado, when I need to get out the summer clothes suitcase so that I'll have more shorts out, that's a sign of spring to where I can't keep wearing pants because I'm absolutely sweating to death every time I go outside. By the way, it was 90 here on Friday. We went for a hike and thought it was only going to be up to 80 and came off the hill and about dropped dead. I mean, it was terribly hot, and it was the first really hot day that we had. But I've noticed here, the birds, I have birds in my tree outside of my balcony that are there all winter, blue jays and cardinals. They come and visit me, these fat little birds, they're adorable. They start to sing when spring is coming. They don't have a peep for us during the winter time, but when it starts to come spring, they start to chirp and they start to sing. And so I've noticed that that's a little something. Also, this tree I just mentioned, it starts to bud. And I have no idea what kind of tree it is. My mother told me, and I can't remember, but it has basically budded out like within 2 days. Like, it's crazy. And it's right out where I sit all the time. So I sit here watching trees and birds. Apparently I'm that person now. But I'm like, okay, even though it's probably going to rain tonight and tomorrow and be 50 degrees again, the spring is coming and it can't go away because I took out the summer clothes suitcase.
Yes. Like, one thing is definitely our little cherry tree out in the front, where the little flowers come on. And now it's actually from last week where the flowers just started. That phase is almost all gone and the leaves are there now. When I have to call and set up the landscaping for the season, that's a sign that it is spring. When I, like, every day, like 15 times a day, I tell myself I have to call. I got to call. I got to let them know we need them to do the yard work, please. So that the little crocuses, that's what I love, though. That's what I remember growing up. The little crocuses, croci. I don't know. What's the plural of crocus? But there's a house that was around the corner where you go walking, and like the whole front lawn was just carpeted with the little flowers. And it just made me so happy. And like what you had also said, I was thinking about that weather whiplash that you get for weeks or months, and then it just kind of slowly molds together and then it goes back. So like every month you're like a little bit warmer, but it's still pow, 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 back and forth.
Steph, you got me with the crocus. We have international teachers who generally come in as spring contract, come sometime in January. And they're here for a good portion of the semester, or even a shorter portion of the semester. And they come from much more warmer parts of the world. And so it's kind of fun, you know, Northeast Ohio, if we had those bitter cold days, to watch them freeze and question, how can you possibly live in this climate? This is terrible. And I try to tell them that people actually live in happy and thrive in this climate. But what I do is when the crocus come out, I have a little patch of them outside my front door. And when I go, you know, to get in the car, I'll notice that they've either broken through the last of the snow or, you know, they've come out. I will immediately take a picture of that and send it out to the international teachers to let them know that spring is happening. So that's the real sign for me.
I think that a lot of this resonates with why I want to ask this question. And first of all, I just want to say bird watching will sneak up on you, Jen. It happens. And it's a thing. I was sitting in my kitchen here and looking out, and I saw a bird that I had never seen before. And I just happened to have a friend over who was significantly older than I am. And she was like, ah, yes, that's a yada, 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 whatever. And I was like, wow, how do you know that? Like, I don't even know anything outside of like robin, blue jay, maybe cardinal, you know, if I'm really focusing, I don't know. So bird watching sneaks up on you. And here in Wisconsin, we are desperate for spring. I feel like you mentioned too that we're getting snow tomorrow. It's started. It's snowing currently. And we're supposed to get 4 inches. And this is spring, I suppose, in Wisconsin. So that's nice. The thing that I noticed the most about spring here is that we have these groundhogs that start to come up. And there's this one field in the Janesville area that I live in that there's like probably 20 of them, or I think there are 20. There's probably actually like 4 or 5, maybe 6. I don't know. And they start to pop up. And so we always look for them every time we drive by there. And when we saw the first one come up this past week, we were shouting in the car, waving our hands. We were like, the groundhogs are back. This is spring. There was still snow on the ground. There is still snow coming. And the groundhogs are back. So I suppose spring is here to stay until it's 90 and humid.
All right. Well, I'm going to shift gears and ask a completely unrelated question. What behavior pisses you off and how do you deal with it?
Well, I think for me, always been bullying. Yeah. And I deal with it responding in kind to the objectionable behavior. But what I was taught is you dial it up by 1 or 2. You want to be a deterrent. It's not always easy, but it is effective.
You know, not much really pisses me off. There's a lot out there that irritates me. I would say injustice pisses me off. I'm thinking like really big things, incompetence and feigning that you have a clue of what you're doing and you're totally out of your depth. We're using the global you here, you know, those types of things that impact people's functioning, their ability to feed their kids and clothe themselves, to eat, to have affordable housing. Those are the things that really piss me off, you know? So, you know, I work for justice. I stick my nose in wherever I can when it comes to the injustice issue. The other one's bigger fish to fry, but, you know, I try to vote for people who are going to hopefully make a difference and do something different locally. You know, I've kind of given up, you know, at the higher levels, but, you know, at the local level of, you know, people who are interested in community housing and, you know, sober living and things of that nature, I try to vote for those folks and support those causes. So I would say that's where I am of what really pisses me off is injustice.
I didn't go that deep because at the same time, I don't want to, because yes, I agree with all of those things. And just because my answer is my answer does not mean I don't care about those issues. I was going to say people who aren't paying attention when they're driving. Sorry, it just sounds so people when they're not paying attention when they're driving and they're blocking me from going and continuing on my path because they're in the wrong lane or something. And what I do is because I know it's not that big of a deal and I shouldn't feel that upset about it and powerless and helpless, I make up little songs about how I want them to move. So, you know, I'll just sing out those curses to the drivers and not even a mean way. It's like it's a gentle tune, you know, but I just, you know, if you're not getting on the highway, move out of the way. Those are the lyrics to one of them.
Wow. I think Broadway's in your future. There could be a, frankly, what's coming out on Broadway, you could do a show on that and it would probably be a hit. I wrote one word when I got this question, entitlement, and people who have a sense of entitlement. How do I deal with it? Well, I get as angry about it, but probably not as much as I get as angry about Outlook. But I get angry about it, and then I'm trying to turn that around and say to myself, I'm getting angry about what I perceive as this other person's sense of entitlement. So it's not all on them. It's about me generating my own anger about it. And then I swear. So, it all comes back.
Wow. You all are better than I am. I had like a laundry list of like specific, odd, random things that really get me fired up. And I'm going to sound like a terrible person, but I'm going to go there anyway. So driving, Steph, I'm kind of in the same vein as you. However, this is a real specific part of driving that really grinds my gears. So driving along on the highway, you're the only person for miles. And suddenly someone comes speeding up next to you and just stops. They legit drive right next to you as you're going 80 miles an hour. down a highway and there's no one else around and they want to drive next to you. Why? Why do people do this? I don't understand. I can't fathom it. Do they just want to look at me in my car? Like, should we wave? Because we're going 80 miles an hour down a road and I don't want to look and wave because then I'm not looking at the road. I don't know. There are deer out here. Who knows? You have a very small margin of error if you're flying, going 80 miles an hour down the highway and someone's like staring right at you. I don't know. It really makes me irritable. So that's one. I mean, I have like this whole laundry list that I could go down. And, you know, Don and I, we had this whole conversation about this. I actually just texted him. I'm like, I should like eliminate some because everyone is like, here's this nice one word. You know, bigger things that actually matter. And I'm like, when someone drives next to me and looks at me, I'm livid. My day is ruined.
I got to say, Gina, that was wonderful. And yeah, I hear you. And that just drives me bonkers too. But I will say, like, in my commute into Cleveland, there's a city, I'm not going to say it's nameless. It's Newburgh Heights. The heck with them. They have traffic cameras. So everybody clusters together. And when you cluster together, they cannot ticket you because you can say, oh, that was a fellow next to me there. And so we do, people who commute regularly, we ride in a pack through Newburgh Heights just to frustrate the traffic cameras. But it sounds like not the situation you're referring to.
No, I'm talking like, you know, late at night, highway, no one's around. I know for sure there are no traffic cameras because I've driven these highways a number of times and never gotten a ticket for going significantly higher than the speed limit.
Sounds a little creepy. I mean, it really sounds like, boy, I've just been waiting for someone to parallel drive with me all my life. And you're the lucky person.
Right? Yeah, I just don't understand it. I just don't. Makes me irrationally mad. So how do I deal with it? I usually try to speed up. And then somehow they also speed up and I'm like, this is just, and then I slam on my brakes and then I fly back, you know, and that's usually how I deal with it is to try to draw back a little bit or go like 100 miles an hour and just zoom past them. Either one, depending on how I'm feeling that day.
That's a Wisconsin response, by the way. I'm just going to go 100. It's good.
Totally. Totally.
I feel like we need to have another segment so we can get the rest of the list. Because now I'm curious, or just email it to me.
I'll send you all the list. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I posted this question because I can't stand meanness for meanness sake, right? It's just people who are just, and it bothers me so much more when it's somebody who's trying to do something to improve themselves. So I came across this TikTok account of a gentleman who frequents a gym. And makes it his mission to call out people who are making fun of others at the gym. So he's a professional trainer, doesn't like the culture that's being built around this. And so he picks through other TikTok accounts to find people who are being mean to those trying to improve themselves. So I was really inspired by that, you know, that account and somebody kind of going to bat in this really kind of unique way for people who are just trying to do something to better themselves. I don't like meanness for meanness sake. So I usually, along with Elliot, kind of lean into my capacity to be meaner than they are. It's something that served me well. And I'm glad to put that power to good use. I'm usually witty with a comeback to go to bat. I feel like I can hold my own. So I jump in. But it's especially frustrating for me when it's meanness for meanness sake.
I think that rounds it out for tonight. We have one final question, which is the final shot question. I got to be honest with you. I stole this from the Clockwise podcast. I thought it was an interesting question and just wanted to see what the squad's reaction is to it. If a crayon color was flavored, what color crayon would you want to eat?
I can speak from my 4-year-old self. Red, always red.
I'm going with Tickle Me Pink.
Purple.
So this is going to sound odd, but I think I'd like to try a few of them. This actually sounds kind of interesting. And the one that I'm going to pick for tonight is Sun Glow Yellow, because I feel like it would taste like sunshine.
Apparently macaroni and cheese is a color. I'm going that direction.
Yeah, I sent and looked at a list of all the Crayola crayon colors. You can Google it and get them in different boxes and stuff. Why anybody would, well, I know why they made a color this, but why anybody would want to eat it? Asparagus. Just not the kind of thing that I want to munch on if I'm eating colored wax. Macaroni and cheese. Timberwolf sounds tasty, depending on how it's cooked. And then burnt sienna. I don't like my sienna burnt. I just want plain sienna. I was disappointed I couldn't find anything related to cherry, because that's one of my favorite flavors, or grape. But I thought of a crayon that I would like to have, basically chips and diet root beer. If we could make a crayon that matches that flavor, I'd be happy. So thanks for the firing squad tonight, Jen, Eric, Steph, Gina, and Elliot. Hey, we've got a live show. Our next show is our 50th show, 50th episode, and it's going to be on Sunday, April 30th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll try and put some announcements out about it. I am going to look for some swag, well, things that I can purchase with a 50th celebration on, and send it out to people who show up. So bring your friends, bring your mentors, bring your parents, bring your kids. We will live stream it and we'll get the information out to you on how to do that. Look for some of these characters on their podcasts on thepodtalk.net. You can find out more about them at circularfiringsquad.net. Our theme music is from Menage a Quad, Real Swing Shet. That's it for this episode of Circular Firing Squad. Ready, fire, aim.